Hello, everyone. We will continue in our Bible study through the book of Matthew, chapter 23 and verse 1. Then spake Jesus to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat." They're in that particular position of authority. The governor and the mayor sit in that position of authority. The president sits in that position of authority, if you know what I'm saying. In other words, we're to respect those in authority and respect their office, but we don't obey them if they teach us to go against God. "All therefore, whatsoever they bid you to observe, that observe and do, but do not you after their works, for they say and do not." They pass laws, they pass traditions, and it doesn't contradict my word. Do that. That's the law of the land. That's the religious requirements of the time in which you're living. But don't be the way they are. Don't follow their example. Do what they say, as long as it doesn't contradict what I say, but don't follow their example, because here's the kind of people they are. They say and they do not. They're hypocrites. And now we get into a very interesting chapter here where he uses this phrase, "Woe unto you." That's a powerful phrase. I think he says it in this chapter about 8 times. I don't know. I haven't carefully really counted it, but I believe it's 7, 8, or 9 times. And when God says, "Woe unto you," that's scary when you think about it. I mean, that's serious. That means you are in trouble. You have done it now. You talk about woe, 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 and more woe. That's what's about to come on you because of the way you are, your attitude, and what you're saying. And that's what he pronounced on these people. And he was very, very strong and powerful in doing it. "For they say and do not," verse 3. Now notice verse 4. "For they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers." They just throw all kind of burdens on the people while they don't bother to do anything toward carrying the burden. Sound familiar today? Yes. People in government pass all these laws that lay heavy burdens on the population, but boy, they're picking high cotton where they are in their high seats of power. "But all their works," verse 5, "they do for to be seen of men." And that's why they do it. Politicians and actors and hypocrites wanting the praise of men and the money that goes along with it. "All their works they do for to be seen of men, for they make broad their phylacteries." They'll take these little leather cases and bind them on their arms with a scripture in there and put them on their forehead with a scripture in there and make them big so everybody knows, "Oh, look at that, he's got phylacteries on. Oh, wow, he must be a real professor. He must be a real scholar. He must be a real holy man." "And enlarge the borders of their garments." Walk around in flowing gowns and religious garb. That sound familiar today? A lot of pomp and ceremony and circumstance. Special hats and holy garments and robes. Meaning what? What does it mean? What does it have to do with anything regarding obeying God, serving God, following Jesus Christ, and serving others? Doesn't have anything to do with anything. It's just a bunch of form without substance. Well, that's the way it was then. "They enlarge the borders of their garments, and they love the uppermost rooms of the feast, the place of honor, and the chief seats in the synagogues, the best place, and greetings in the markets, and to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But be you not called Rabbi, for one is your master," and that's what Rabbi means, "one is your master, even Christ, and all you are brethren. Call no man your father upon earth, for one is your father which is in heaven. Neither be you called masters, for one is your master, even Christ." Now this is talking about a religious term. It's talking about being called a religious term. And it's a point of vanity, and it's a point of arrogance, where these religious terms are thrown around. You know, in the Catholic Church, the priests are called father. And in the Jewish church, the leaders are called Rabbi, Rabbi. And I guess in some organizations, yeah, I know this, they're called Master. And these are religious terms, and God says, don't be using these religious terms when referring to people. These are terms like Reverend that should be only used in referring to God the Father. Not that we call him Rabbi, but we call him Father and call Jesus Christ our Master. And they are reverent. but no man is reverend. So in God's church, the ministers are not called reverend, and they're not called master or father or rabbi. A term of respect is mister. That's the tradition in our society today, and so the ministers are referred to as mister, a term of respect. Now, one reason why we know this is talking about religious terminology or religious offices, it says, call no man your father, but yet it says in the Bible, honor your father and your mother. Well, I mean, you know, you call your dad father, that's fine, and your mother, but it's not a religious office and a religious term. It's a family office and a family term. This is using these terms in a way that should be reserved only to God, who we worship. We worship God. We don't worship religious leaders, although they do in some organizations and some churches. And they say their leaders can forgive sin and you confess to them and so on and so forth. Well, they were doing that then and they loved it and they do it now and they love it. And God says, don't do that, because that is not my way, and that is not what my people do. He goes on to explain. Verse 10, neither be you called masters, for one is your master, even Christ. But he that is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's the highest position. The one that serves is the great person. And whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased, humbled, and he that shall humble himself shall be exalted. This is a law right here. If you humble yourself, God will take care of exalting you. If you exalt yourself, God will take care of humbling you. It's a lot easier if we humble ourselves rather than God having to humble us or somebody else having to humble us. Now notice verse 13, what he says here. Woe unto you. And he keeps saying that. I sure don't want him to ever say that to me. I don't want to hear that. This is a very frightening thing. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, you know. But we stand in awe of him and we're in his hands, but it's all in love. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, neither suffer you them that are entering to go in. If you can't have it, you don't want anybody else to have it. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore you shall receive the greater condemnation or damnation. Long prayers don't mean a thing. In public, showing out in front of people. Now, long prayers in private on your knees, talking to God, yes, if that's what it turns out to be. But these long show-off public prayers, often read and insincere, all for the sake of drawing attention to yourself, is nothing but hypocrisy. That's what he's saying here. Therefore, you shall receive the greater damnation. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you compass or you travel sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he is made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves. You try to go bring people to you. You try to go out and get people to follow you. And you go to great lengths to do that. And when you get him, you mislead him, you confuse him, you deceive him, and you put him in a position that he's going to go into the lake of fire if he keeps following what you teach. And he'll have to be rescued and called and shown the truth so that doesn't happen. But left alone, that's where you're taking him. Woe unto you, you blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing, but whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he is a debtor, obligated to perform it. You fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? All about money for you. Whosoever shall swear by the altar, it is nothing, but whosoever swears by the gift that is upon it, he's guilty. It's one and the same, he's saying. You parse these words and turn it around to where you get something, when in fact, what you're teaching is error and wrong, and yet you've deceived people into believing it. So you can end up getting the gift. You can end up getting the gold. you fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Whoso therefore shall swear by the altar swears by it and by all things thereon. It's the same thing. And whoso shall swear by the temple swears by it and by him that dwells therein. And he that shall swear by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him that sits thereon. And so therefore God says, swear not at all. In other places in the Bible, swear not at all. Don't do it. But according to your teaching, if they follow your teaching, when they swear about the temple or about the altar or the gift on the altar, you can't separate the two. They go together. You hypocrites. You evil, lying fools that are blind, and you make others blind if they listen to you. Verse 23, woe unto you. See how often he says this? Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought you to have done, and not to leave the other undone. And so what Jesus Christ is saying here is, when you tithe, you make such a production out of it, and you get so picky about it, and so self-righteous about it, that you get all consumed about counting out every little berry and every little leaf and every little twig, and you forget all about the bigger matters of judgment, mercy, and faith. That's where you ought to focus, judgment, mercy, and faith, and also, by the way, make sure you're tithing properly. Do them both. But the emphasis ought to be on the weightier matters, but don't neglect the other, because God says if you neglect tithing, you're robbing him. But you don't have to tithe like they tithed. Count out every little mint and anise and cumin. Spend time on judgment, mercy, and truth, and also make sure you get that done. You blind guides, verse 24, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Get all wrought up about some picky little thing and miss the main point because of being so self-righteous and so petty. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you may clean the outside of the cup and of the platter of the dish, but within they are full of extortion and excess. It's all got to be clean and shiny outside because that's what people see. But what really counts is get it clean inside. Be clean outside, but especially clean inside because that's where the food goes. You look all great and good on the outside, but what's your heart like? What's your mind like? What are you like on the inside? Get the inside right, and then that'll take care of the appearance. That's why we don't judge by appearance. You can look and say, well, she doesn't look so great, but she may be a wonderful person because she's got character. Or you might say, well, boy, she looks tremendous, but she might not be such a wonderful person because she doesn't have character on the inside. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, and hypocrites, for you may clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. You blind Pharisee, clean first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. Both of them need to be clean, but first things first, which is the inside. That's what's first. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outside, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. And there are tombs in some places where people will splash white paint on there and make them look shiny, but inside they're terrible. And instead of getting the inside clean and orderly, and then if you want to paint the outside, fine. We're not talking about the kind of tombstones we have nowadays, but in the Middle East and also back in that time, some of the tombs, you know, you could walk in there. The person would be buried over in the corner maybe and then covered with this big tomb. Well, instead of keeping it clean inside and over there where the person was interred and was actually in a grave, they allowed the inside to get full of junk. But, oh, outside it was all clean and polished. And he was saying, clean up the inside, and if you want to polish the outside, fine. He's talking about character. He's talking about attitude. He's talking about obeying God and doing things from the heart first, and then take care of the outside. Do them both, but first things first. repeating, verse 27, woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like unto whited sepulchres, whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness, and are not kept nice and orderly. Even so you also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within you are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. In other words, bury the bones and then keep it clean inside that big shelter, that tomb. But here's what he's talking about. Even so you also outwardly, you appear righteous unto men, but the way you really are, you're full of hypocrisy and iniquity. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous, and say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Wherefore you be witnesses unto yourselves that you are the children of them which killed the prophets. Oh, yes, you try to identify with Abraham, you try to identify with the prophets of old, but it's your ancestors and you in your heart that were the type of people that killed them. But you try to be associated with them in an advantageous way now. But you can't do it because you are hypocrites. And you are the children of them, spiritually speaking even, which kill the prophets. You have the same attitude of those which kill the prophets. Fill you up then the measure of your fathers, the measure of guilt of your fathers, because you're just like them and just as guilty as they were. You serpents, see how strong it gets? You snakes. You serpents, you generation of vipers, how can you escape the damnation of hell? Wherefore, behold, I send unto you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of them you shall kill and crucify, and some of them shall you scourge in your synagogues and persecute them from city to city. And that happened before, and it's happened several times in the past. And there could be some martyrdoms in the future because of the truth and because of being a true servant and not caving in for the sake of living a little longer. The person can end up being severely persecuted and even martyred. Verse 35, and you persecute them from city to city, that upon you may come all the righteous blood shed upon the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel unto the blood of Zechariah, son of Berechias, whom you slew between the temple and the altar. And you can read about that over in 2 Chronicles 24, verse 20 and 21. Verily I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation, because you're like the past generations, enemies of God and hypocrites and pharisaical and rebellious and self-righteous. And what happened to the past self-righteous enemies of God is going to happen to you because you're like them. So they came trying to prance around and build a reputation by attacking him, and it backfired big time on them, and he put them in their place. You see, God is full of love, and he's full of meekness, and he's full of compassion, but he's also full of power and strength and righteous indignation, and he has anger toward sin and toward evil, not toward people, but toward sin and evil and toward the evil deeds and actions of these people. He hates sin, and we should too. And so while we want to be humble and we want to be meek in terms of our attitudes and in terms of our demeanor, we also want to be strong and powerful in terms of our character and in terms of our resistance to evil and resistance to sin and standing our ground for what is right. And we can be very strong in doing that. And sometimes we can be very strong in what we say as we do that, and in what we write as we do that. We don't attack anybody. We don't lose our temper and lose control, but sometimes we can be very forceful and very strong about, no, I am not going to do that. I will not break the Sabbath. And I'm not going to put a Christmas tree up. And no, I am not going to do what you tell me to do if it's against what God tells me to do. That's the attitude that we see here that Jesus Christ was showing that we ought to follow. We abhor that which is evil. We cleave to that which is good. And if it means being strong about it, we're that way. There's a proverb that says, the righteous are bold as a lion, but the wicked flee when none pursues. So while we're humble and meek, we can also be bold when it comes to righteousness and when it comes to the truth, and be strong when it calls for strength, whatever circumstance we're in. And that's what you see here in Jesus Christ. Verily, verse 36, I say unto you, all these things shall come upon this generation. Now look at the love and the meekness and the compassion he has for his people, for Jerusalem, for his church, and eventually for the whole world when they repent. Verse 37, though, specifically for Jerusalem and for his people Israel and for spiritual Israel, his true church in this end time. But here, speaking of Jerusalem at that time and how, instead of being the city that he loved and that obeyed him, they had become a city that was filled with evil and evil people. And it was really very sad for him to recognize that as he came into Jerusalem and now soon was to be crucified there. Verse 37, Matthew 24, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you that kill the prophets, meaning the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the high priest, the Roman soldiers, and all that were in Jerusalem that made up the population of Jerusalem, they did that. You that kill the prophets and stone them which are sent unto you, how often would I have gathered your children together, even as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not. I've seen that happen, and if you haven't seen it, try to see it sometime. It's really something. A mother hen, maybe a storm is coming, or maybe a hawk is flying overhead. She'll start clucking, and she'll get all those little chickens, and she'll sweep them under her wings and cover them and protect them, and she'll give her life to protect them. It's what Christ feels about those that he loves and wants to serve and wants to take care of, which are his people and eventually the whole world, and which Jerusalem should have been, but they turned on him because of all the evil that went on there. He said, if you'd only been different, I would have taken you under my wings as a mother hen does her chickens. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate because you have turned your back on God and on his laws. For I say unto you, verse 39, you shall not see me henceforth till you shall say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. You've rejected me, so now you're not going to see me again until I come as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And from here, of course, he's moving closer and closer to being arrested, to being beaten all night, and to being crucified in Jerusalem by the people of Jerusalem, not his people, but those who are disobeying him and really enemies of his, when really he would have loved to come into Jerusalem and had the whole city give him the welcome that he got from the few that paved the way as he rode in on the colt. But that's not the welcome he got from the whole city. That is the welcome he will get when he returns again as King of Kings and Lord of Lords and puts down all nations in the day of the Lord and sets up his kingdom on earth in Jerusalem. And then that city will become the city of God, and it will rejoice because he's there. Worship him and welcome him from the heart with their whole heart. So that's coming in the kingdom. Well, that brings us to chapter 24. So we'll stop there and pick it up with chapter 24 next time. Until then, this is Charles Bryce with the Enduring Church of God.